Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we are recording this a couple days before Christmas, which means it's also about a week before next year's Gospel Doctrine new cycle of scriptures that they take on every year, and this year coming up, it will be the Old Testament. Many of you have been aware that we're doing a series on Genesis where we've done the creation and we've done the flood narratives. We're going to get to Tower of Babel and a few other things and get into Abraham and stuff soon. So I don't want to overdose everybody on Old Testament stuff, but this is going to be completely different than what we're trying to do there, which is a very close reading of the text. What we're doing here is just sort of a presentation of what is this particular set of scriptures, the Old Testaments? How has it been handled throughout Christian history? How do Mormons handle it? Are we, like most Christians, do we Christianize the Old Testament? Do we read a lot of things from Jesus' life back into it? In other words, are we looking at what the gospel writers did where they were looking very much for things that prophesied of Jesus and connections and things like that? Do we uncritically read those things, which I think we do? And then specifically, what is the actual Mormonizing? What specific Mormon things do we also read into it as well? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? We just want to have a good, frank, and full discussion as best we can. As much as possible, we'd like our conversation today to be practical for those who are going to be attending Gospel Doctrine classes, for those who might be teaching it, and just have a good 90 minutes together today on this wonderful set of scriptures. I'll stop there. The reason we're having this conversation was just a neat little email exchange with Jana Reese and I. Jana's with us again. And Jana, I want you to do your normal broad introduction of who you are and things like that, but we definitely have to talk about the Twible, which I know is what brought the Old Testament to your mind.
All right. Well, hi, I'm Jana Reese, and it's a delight to be back on the Mormon Matters podcast with you all. And so most recently, I'm the author of The Twible. The subtitle is All the Chapters of the Bible in 140 Characters or Less, Now with 68% More Humor. So,
and it is.
As you could imagine, yeah, this is a lighter look at the Bible, both the Old and the New Testaments. And so the project began in 2009 when I started tweeting out a chapter of the Bible every day on Twitter. And trying to encapsulate it in 140 characters, but also trying to make it fun and entertaining so that all of us who were reading the Bible together would enjoy this community that we were creating. And so the book that resulted from that four-year project has just come out, and it is, the print book has a lot of informative sidebars as well as the tweets themselves, and it has about 51 cartoons.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
Thank you. I will pass that on to the cartoonist. It's been a great joy to work with him. So that just came out, and so the process of exploring the Old Testament in this much deeper way has raised some questions for me, and also in conversation with other Mormons about how I was going to handle certain passages, like Ezekiel 37 is an example of that. It raised some interesting questions about how we deal with the Old Testament in Mormon theology and culture, and how we teach it more specifically.
Yes, that is a better introduction than I did, so. But thank you to what we're trying to do today. A little bit wider, you're the author of Flunking Sainthood, and that's your blog. And tell us a little bit about your blog and that book.
Yes, so Flunking Sainthood was a memoir of failing at 12 different spiritual practices. It's not enough just to fail at one or two. I had to fail at everything.
Yeah.
So that's, again, on the lighter side, it's a humorous memoir, but I hope that there are some deeper takeaways about how we handle failure in Christian life, because failure is a an important part of Christian life and how we cope with that. So the book came out in 2011. I also blog under the same name. So my blog is called Flunking Sainthood, and it moved last year from BeliefNet, where it began, to Religion News Service, where it is still hosted today. I love RNS. And so I blog about a number of different things, Mormonism usually once or twice a week, and a couple of other topics that I enjoy covering, things that are in the news about religion or popular culture, in particular spirituality and just grief lately, actually.
Yes.
Whatever's on my mind.
Yeah. And I'm guessing with the Olympics coming up, we're going to get some figure skating.
Hey, I have to have at least one sport. I mean, I'm so out of touch with all the football talk and basketball. Basically, all I know about those sports is what I see people posting on Twitter. So I have to have my revenge somehow. God.
That's right. I love it, though. It's great. Anyway, thank you so much, Jana. Welcome back. And we always love you having you. So, Phil Barlow, I think you're back for either the third or the fourth time on Mormon Matters. We love having you back. Would you quickly remind everybody what you do for a living and all those good things, and as well as probably the main reason that you're here is a book that was recently republished?
Oh, thanks, Dan. I am glad to be on with you again and with Jana and Carrie. I teach religious studies up at Utah State University in Logan, and the book you allude to, Mormons and the Bible, was actually my first academic book, and it's just been issued by Oxford in a new updated edition.
Yeah, it was a great, great new introduction. What else did you adjust in there?
Well, the new preface is the core of what's new there, and the two things I try to accomplish there is, one, to estimate what I take to be significant developments in the last 20 years since the book was first published, what's gone on with Mormonism and the Bible in those two decades. Writing the preface prompted me to reflect a bit on what a changed world it is just since that book was first published. There wasn't an internet for popular usage then, and Cold War was just ending and the Berlin Wall coming down, and terrorism was not yet in the foreground as it is, and Islam therefore was not in the foreground of people's consciousness in the way that it is, and the religious folks who were spiritual but not religious, or everybody's their own religion movement that is arisen, was less obvious to everyone. So the world itself has changed. The other thing I tried to do in the new edition of the book is to recast Joseph Smith's mission. I suggest in there that the Joseph Smith we carry around in our heads is too small for what he was trying to accomplish, despite the grand and even grandiose heights to which his followers raise him or his enemies raise him. I think we as a people, and I as an author, when I was writing the first edition, did not really grasp the expansiveness of what he's trying to pull off, which I've been thinking about in recent years. And so in a separate article that I draw from in writing the preface, I call it To Mend a Fractured Reality, Joseph Smith's Mission. And that means every aspect of reality that is crucial to human beings, that is politics and economics and religion, and for Christians and Jews, the Bible and heaven and earth and death and the nature of time and the nature of language and the nature of geography, all fundamental relations, human relations and divine human relations, Joseph perceived as fragmented, I'm arguing, and that his enterprise was a sort of a vast atonement, at-one-ment, not, of course, displacing what he perceived Christ to be doing, but as an extension and a part of that. He was trying to heal all of these fractures.
Yeah. And somehow this big project of Joseph Smith, it'll work into some of the things I know you're going to talk about today about ancient Israel and restoration and things. So thrilled for that. Now, quickly, I was aware of your Mending a Fractured Reality as a title of a talk, because you gave the Eugene England lecture once with that. Has the article come out yet, or is that something I can link folks to?
Yes. Well, again, the best introduction to it may be the preface of the new edition of the book, but it's more amplified in an article in the 2007 Journal of Mormon History.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize when I was hearing you at the England lecture that it was based on something that had already been published. Okay, great.
Well, oh, thanks. Did I say 2007? No, 2012. It had not been published.
Oh, okay. So now it's out. Okay, got it. So
sorry,
it's in
I was
the two.
Working out those ideas when I came to talk down there. Yeah.
Right. Good stuff. Well, I will link to that if I can. I'm not quite sure what JMH is doing as far as letting their content be free, but I'll try. So thank you so much. We're excited to hear from you again. Carrie Miles, welcome to Mormon Matters for the first time. You and I are old acquaintances from my years at Sunstone. You would come and you'd give these great, interesting talks. A lot of them related to Old Testament and creation and Song of Songs, Song of Solomon stuff. So I just thought of you, and then just in our pre-conversation, I'm just so thrilled that you're here to offer a bunch of perspectives. So introduce yourself, please.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dan. I'm delighted to be here and very interested to hear what Jana and Phil have been saying. I am a social psychologist. I went to BYU, not very up on current Mormon matters. So I'm interested to hear what you've been alluding to as far as Ezekiel or Isaiah. You've been talking about 37. I am a social psychologist, and my husband is an economist of the Gary Becker School. Becker won the Nobel Prize in 87 for using economic tools to look at non-market behavior. So I applied this to the Old Testament, and especially Genesis 3, where you have the fall and then go from there. And what you find when you look at the Old Testament in particular, from the point of view of kind of what life is like, what the family is like, what the relationship between man and woman is like in the fallen world that you get after Genesis 2, is really quite a bit different from the kind of family that we look at, or that we assume, with our 2,000 years of Christian heritage. So if you go back and you read the Old Testament through this kind of eyes, a lot of the words that we think we know the meaning of, like love and marriage, they're using in a different way than we intend. And it gives you a different understanding of the whole enterprise that's going on. In the last several years, I've been working in Africa, teaching a lot of this material that I published in a book in 2006 called The Redemption of Love. And Africa, of course, is much, economically, it's much closer to the kind of world we see in the Bible than what we in the United States, I think it's almost impossible. We're talking about Christianizing or Mormonizing the Bible, but we also have to think of our whole kind of modernity aspect of reading the Bible. It's really very hard for people to understand what's going on in the Old Testament when we're assuming, you know, a world where you don't have to spend all day just cleaning the beans before you can cook them.
Mm.
Which are a very different kind of world that people were living in. So you end up with a different way of looking at the Bible. And that comes out very clearly, I think, in a lot of African contexts. And the biggest problem we see with the way women are treated in, say, Africa today is that they're reading the Bible through African eyes, and in some ways they understand it better than we do, but they're also reading it in terms of what they were taught by the 19th century British missionaries. So for something like, let's take Genesis 3, this is the fall and the curse on the ground. The British missionaries taught them that woman was responsible for the fall and that God cursed woman in Genesis 3. Now, of course, you can still find churches in the U.S. that teach that the woman is cursed, but we don't practice witchcraft, and we do not understand what a curse is, which they do in Africa. So, it's it's really very interesting, and it gives you a different perspective on things. Basically, the bottom line for me that you take away with is that people look at the world that's recorded in the Old Testament as far as the treatment of woman and family and say it's a very sexist culture, a very anti-woman culture. But when you understand what life is like in the fallen world without any kind of redemption, or in the case of the Old Testament, this kind of schoolmaster, that God was protecting the people, he hadn't brought us to redemption yet in Christ, but what the prophets are doing is trying to protect us from the effects of the sin. That a lot of the things that people read as being very detrimental or derogatory of women in the Old Testament are in fact trying to ameliorate the worst aspects of what's going on in that world around them.
Wow, that is some fascinating material, Carrie. We'll work that in, but it's just great to have these extra perspectives to say this is such a fascinating text. It's such a broad thing, and I'm so excited to be tuned into that. And I'm especially going to be interested as you teach in Africa and as you work with these folks. I would love to hear, you know, again, how you frame various things, because I imagine what we're going to kind of all say here with, you know, in the context of a gospel doctrine Mormon Sunday school class is we can't probably unload the whole cart at once, right? We can't do all the biblical criticism. We can't, you know, totally, you know, bring all of our sophisticated tools to it. So what can you share and what can't you say? Have you had to wrestle with that particular, like, how much is too much? Because some of this stuff does serve them well, even if it's completely not textual.
Yes, well, the way we operate, we're in Africa, India, and Haiti now. Interesting, all three cultures have picked up this idea that the woman is cursed, and there's no other common thread here except the 19th century British missionaries. But what we do is we work with leaders who are trying to change their communities around these issues. And our Bible study guide, it's all biblically based material, but we do introduce these ideas in the study. And we break up the group into small groups. Each one does a different study. They work through the material themselves. And then they come back and they teach each other what they've learned. And they make their own cultural applications. And so it's just a lot of this that we don't have to deal with. But we do tell them that there's a surprise in every study. The questions that we're asking them are pretty leading, I will admit that.
Okay.
But I guess that's different from your typical Mormon Sunday school setting where they are, you know, being taught out of a manual. But I mean, we're working in a different cultural context at all. We can't tell them how to apply this material because we don't have a clue even what's going through their heads.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
Kind of.
Yeah.
It was just interesting to learn. It'll come out. The way I frame some questions down the road, we'll kind of get to it. But thank you. It's so great to have you on board and introduce you to this audience. So,
thank you.
I can see lots of other topics that we'll have to just do separate podcasts on later. But Phil, I wanted to go back to you because you were kind of talking about this broader framing of Joseph Smith as healing a fractured reality, and, you know, he's a restorer, he's a healer, and all those kinds of different things. And you'd kind of made some interesting comments in pre-conversation about how when you teach the Old Testament, or when you want to present the Old Testament, one of the first questions you want to get at is, let's take a look at what this concept of ancient Israel is, what is it all about, and how that plays into Joseph Smith's mindset, and especially the concept of restoration. Do you mind kind of just launching into, you know, however long it takes to kind of frame that for us?
I think it's helpful when we're in our Sunday school classes or anywhere thinking about the Hebrew Bible to try to identify with them first before we do linking with our own Latter-day Saint faith to try to understand them on their own terms. They were not Latter-day Saints, and they were not proto-Latter-day Saints in their own understanding. They were ancient Hebrew people, and it's kind of useful to think in the history of Mesopotamia, in the context of their time and place, what was distinctive about them as in relation to other religions around them. And for Sunday school purposes, I should think it's helpful at least to get at some basics like what is classically called ethical monotheism. That is, ancient Israel came, like everybody else of their time and place, from a polytheistic world. And there's plenty of traces of a lingering polytheism in the biblical and extra-biblical documents. But the overall thrust is towards a monotheism and towards a kind of God who is not merely the personification of some form of power like fertility or destruction or the god of the sea or of lightning or of the sun, but a god who cares preeminently about goodness, about righteousness, and a god who is himself righteous. And we may take that too for granted, but it's a distinctive development.
Yeah. Interesting. So you would feel comfortable doing 5 or 10 minutes on laying out those differences? And do you have a quick example of, you know, how that would connect with a Mormon audience so that it's not just an abstract idea? What would you then say, for example?
Well, let me give you a few for examples and then maybe link it to Joseph Smith specifically again. Ancient Israel did not produce statues, physical descriptions of their God. Thou shalt not make graven images. And that's distinctive. All the other gods that we know about or that I know about in the ancient world are imaged some way. And it's almost as though the commandment is trying to deflect the human impulse to picture too readily, which may have the implication of getting too chummy with God, too familiar, thinking you understand when you don't. And the ancients, Israelites, thought of God's actions or activity in a distinctive way. God in the early parts of the Bible is seen as active in the great events of history, archetypically the Exodus from slavery in Egypt, for instance. And the ancient Israelites thought of time in a distinctive way, so as opposed to the circular notions of history, the cyclic notions of history that were common. God is the God of the seasons and the years and recurrent births and deaths. In Asia, it takes forms of reincarnation. You can hear vestiges of it in the book of Ecclesiastes. There is nothing new under the sun, and that which is has been before and will be again. But as opposed to those things, Israel thinks of God entering human history and releasing the people from slavery or making new things happen, and that allows for eventually a modern-ish sense of history, or a Western sense of history, as not exactly linear, but unfolding in a path with new things genuinely happening. And why that's not just abstract, but should interest us Latter-day Saints, is it makes possible notions of individualism, individual actions that matter, that are not merely subservient to these broad cosmic forces. And so it affects assumptions that we have today within the church. So if I'm not going on too long, I'll try.
No, keep going.
Joseph Smith.
Please.
So our tendency to Christianize the Hebrew Bible has a long history, like Martin Luther thought you couldn't interpret a single chapter of the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, without Christ in mind, that it was really all prototypes or signals or strands of Christ. And we can recognize something of that understanding in some of Joseph Smith's work.
Right.
And our tendency to Mormonize early Christianity, or Mormonize the Bible, or Mormonize, for our discussion this afternoon, the Hebrew Bible, I think is conditioned to a great degree by a particular understanding of restoration, the restoration that is in most of our heads, which is one fundamental way that Joseph Smith did indeed talk about and enact restoration, is to bring back that which once was historically and then has been lost by accident or by conspiring scribes adding to or taking away from scriptural texts, prophetic authority, or some of the plain and precious truths. Sorry about that telephone. But Joseph talked in other ways about restoration, and a second way he used it was not just to bring back that which has been allegedly lost, but to repair that which is broken. So I argue that he saw the world as fundamentally fragmented. Part of this is conditioned by his time and place in the new United States, the first generation to come of age after the American Revolution broke tradition to smithereens. So the ancient, earlier centuries, European society was held together by a sovereign. So if I'm a serf at the bottom of the social ecology, it's not fair, but the ecology, the social fabric, is coherent. Everybody owes somebody above them in the social classes something, and can make use of people below them. And so the fabric holds together. It's sort of like if you watch Downton Abbey before things start to change, you can see that there's a whole ranking of servants, a whole hierarchy of servants even before you get to the main family. And then there's a hierarchy among the royals or the aristocrats. And you have to imagine if there was a sudden revolution for the Downton Abbey society, what would happen to each of those lives if the changes didn't happen gradually but exploded in a single 10 or 20 year period because of a revolution. So Joseph inherited a reality, a society like that. So economics were fragmented, what families meant were fragmented, divorce was increasing rapidly. As Alexis de Tocqueville and Ralph Waldo Emerson and others wrote about, the extended family was contracted into the nuclear family, and generational amnesia was happening, and capitalism was let loose in a wild way, and the Industrial Revolution brought more change and chaos. So when we talk about Joseph trying to restore all things or trying to establish Zion, we need to hear him thinking about a restoration that addresses these fragments. He talks about a broken, imperfect, scattered language, and he talks about the days of Peleg in the Old Testament when the continents were separated, and he looks forward to a time when they'll be reunited. Zion in its political and its economic dimensions, its kingdom building that has elements of democracy, but also elements of the old ways of an envisioned coherent society under a benevolent king. So family, language, geography, the nature of time itself, economics, class systems, the fragmented religious system, the generations that need to be reconnected, all of that is a part of a restoration which addresses that which is broken. a third type of restoration that Joseph enacted, even though he sometimes spoke about it in oblique ways, is not to bring back which historically once was, nor just to repair that which was broken, but to complete that which was partial. So he drew language from the New Testament, from Matthew 13, for example, in casting the Lord as speaking of things which have been kept hidden from before the foundation of the world. And so he's referring in particular to temple ordinances and the theology that is going to thrust towards deification. So that's different than the other types. And a fourth one that I've thought about, and I've also been influenced by Kathleen Flake a little bit in thinking about this, but I've independently been thinking about Mormonism and the concept of time, and I have written about that and teach a class about religion and the concept of time, is that Joseph reimagines the past and even reconfigures the past as part of mapping out the Mormon mythos, the Mormon cosmic plan of salvation and what's going on in reality. And he does it in the mode, I think, of a prophetic Targum, as the Hebrew scholars put it, not necessarily as the Bible once was, but as the Bible should be or should be,
right,
to communicate the complete picture that reflects his revelations. And this is done so as to realize, to make clear, make a map, a picture, a prophetic pronouncement and warning and encouragement towards God's intentions for the world, God's work and glory, as Moses 1 and 39 puts it. So I'm thinking about other ways and forms of restoration outside Mormonism too, but so far I'm sensitive to the Mormon prophets' use of those different applications of restoration. And instead of that coming across as scholarly technicality, I think it's highly relevant to how we use and how we see the restoration, including the Old Testament and including the Joseph Smith translation, for instance, of the Old Testament. And I think it's relevant to the broad widening faith crisis within Mormonism, that people have this notion of restoration that is just restoring old things the way they once were before an apostasy, right, or a series of apostasies. And when they find difficulties in that model, when they learn a little bit about earliest Christianity and it isn't organized exactly how Mormonism is organized either now or in 1830, or lots of other examples could be marshaled, then it can create a fracture. And if one has a brittle faith that is just based on my first sense of Joseph's restoration. So I think we need a more pliable, organic, and much more broad notion of how he was acting with this term, and it could be helpful for people's resilience in relation to the faith.
Okay, that's actually resilience in relation to the faith. That's a very interesting thing. So in some ways, are you saying if you were to present this, and if this were just to be sort of a consistent message of don't limit yourself to just this, you know, that it's okay as a prophet to actually reimagine the past and to reframe it all, and that's part of his thing, or to, you know, restore what was hidden from the world. If you're able to do that, when you say resilience, does that mean resilience when it comes to the fact that they might just all of a sudden through their studies or even through what you would introduce in class or whatever, you might throw them for a faith loop because, you know, something's mythic rather than literal or something like that? I guess I'm trying to get a feel for the resiliency piece.
Yeah, well, my understanding of mythic, such a dangerous world out there, a dangerous word in the public domain, because people want to think, is this true or is this just a myth?
Right.
My notion of a myth is a highly symbolic narrative that gets at the things that matter most, whether it's historical or not.
Good, so good. That's great.
If I'm in a Sunday school class as opposed to my university classroom, and so my context is that of fostering faith, if I'm in a Sunday school or church class, as opposed to the university setting where I'm just studying about these things, yeah, then I say, if someone's disturbed about something, I don't go out of my way to try to turn my classroom into a university classroom. But so remembering that the context is devotional, still, if someone's bothered by this or that that comes up in the realm that I'm talking about, then I try to remind everybody that we may sell Joseph Smith short, we may sell the Lord short by a constricted view of how Joseph was operating as a prophet and what he meant by restoration, just like Job's friends were very upset about Job in the story of Job, the book of Job, and it turns out in their relentless defense of God that they offended not just Job, but God. And at the end of the story, God will only talk to them through Job because they have not done well as my servant Job has done. And yet all they did was defend God. And so the problem seems to be that they defended God far too zealously with far too confident a map of what reality was like and what God was doing. Mm-hmm. It was not only too small, but even offensive to God.
Lovely. That is great. That really helps. That was a perfect answer for that. Jana, where are you now? We've heard a couple of really neat extended comments from those folks. You did the Twibel. Is that what was that experience like for you? How is the Old Testament different for you now than it was before? And, you know, if you had any goals for, you know, injecting into a Sunday school or devotional, you know, / educational kind of situation, what were highlighted for you that you would hope would come alive this year?
Well, I think that the manual, you know, I used to be a gospel doctrine teacher. I did that for 2.5 years. It's not my current calling, but I'm still very interested in how we teach the Bible in the church. And I think that we do a good job with some things, particularly application. We do a very fine job with helping people apply the Bible to their lives and to get kernels of righteous living from some of these stories. However, I would say that we just allied important historical distinctions between biblical cultures, plural, and our culture today. And this came home to me even before I was a Mormon when I went to visit the visitor center at the Washington, D.C. temple. I think I was about 21. And there was a sister missionary there who had some kind of physical diorama of Solomon's temple. I don't remember much about this, but there was some physical representation of that. And she said that just like Solomon's temple was the temple for the people of his time and God resided there, so too God was living right next door in the Washington, D.C. temple, and that it was essentially just the same experience. And it isn't the same experience at all. The temple experience in the time of Solomon and the temple experience for Latter-day Saints today is quite different. I wanted to ask her, are you sacrificing animals in there? You know, what are you actually doing inside that temple? Because I wasn't Mormon and I wouldn't have a way to know that firsthand. I didn't say that. I was very polite and she was very sweet and earnest and I wouldn't want to hurt her feelings. But it's a good question, you know. Why do we say that? Why do we say that our temple is the same as the temple of old when we're not sacrificing animals and we don't have a holy of holies in which one man goes into that special room on only one day a year to atone for the people? You know, there are very important differences, but we are so intent on claiming that heritage for ourselves and tying our temple experience to the Old Testament. Why do we do that?
So it's a problem. How significant a problem is it for you? Like, is it enough to speak up in Sunday school as the non-teacher?
Well, thankfully, I'm in primary. So I'm not in Sunday school.
Imagine that you're sitting there and this happens right in front of you. You know, I'd love to hear from everybody on this.
Yeah. In my ward, we happen to have a fantastic gospel doctrine teacher. So I can't imagine that happening. She's amazing and does a lot of background reading. She's great. But it, I'm sure, happens many other places that these kinds of historical issues arise. Ezekiel 37, I mentioned at the top, you know, I was a Mormon, I think, for several years before I heard the idea that the stick of Israel and the stick of Judah were supposed to represent the Bible and the Book of Mormon, and that the prophecy was really about the coming together of those two things. In the Gospel Doctrine Manual, there is a quote from Boyd K. Packer, who says that this Ezekiel's prophecy now stands fulfilled because that has happened, and we have both of those scriptures. And while I agree with the tenor, the spirit of what he's trying to say, he says that when you are poring over one, you're drawn to the other, and as you learn from one, you are enlightened by the other. I completely agree with that, and that's been my experience. But historically, I think it's really important that we start teaching people the historical context of what Ezekiel was addressing in his time, which was the exile. And for centuries, by the time of Ezekiel, the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom had been divided. I mean, it's like North and South Korea, you know, with terrible pain from that division. And so to have a prophecy at this horrible time, like the worst possible time of Israel's history, people are dying, people are being taken into exile, into captivity, and there's this sudden prophecy. Not only are we going to be returned to our land, but we're going to be together again for the first time in hundreds of years. How powerful that would be. And for Mormons to just blithely come, you know, back in history and grab whatever we want to from the Old Testament without also teaching this history, I think is insulting to the people who suffered, I have to say. I mean, don't we owe it to those people to try to understand what this prophecy would have meant to them before we also try to understand it in our own context? And I believe that prophecy is multivalent. I believe that prophecy can have multiple meanings. I'm not saying that the Mormon interpretation is wrong. I'm just saying that we owe it to the Bible to try to understand their context.
Right. So you could gladly, as a gospel doctrine teacher, teach both what likely was really going on then, as well as teach the Boyd K. Packer look. I believe he gave that talk right in 1989 when the new scriptures came out with the full footnoting that kind of linked both, you know, Bible and the triple combination together and all that kind of stuff, right?
It says 1982, yeah.
Oh, what? Anyway, I kind of remember him, you know, holding up the Bible and the triple in conference or something like that. So you could teach them both, and I agree with you. Just for those, while we're on this Ezekiel 37 section, it starts with like verse 16, the stick of Joseph and the stick of Judah. Mormons typically say, well, the stick is obviously referring to a scroll, so it is dealing with writings. Almost all the biblical commentators just talk about it being sort of a tribal rod. There's a passage in Numbers 17 that talks about each of the tribes having a staff. And so this idea of the two rods coming together and being held together, like you say, the people coming together. Also, what's interesting to me is it's right after this wonderful dry bones, you know, the Valley of the Dry Bones. Ezekiel's there and he's, you know, being told by God to prophesy to these bones and you know, all these fallen Israelites, like you say, there's been these great wars, these great divisions, and they could use some hope. And so he starts talking to them, and the bones come together, the sinews and all that stuff. And then he starts talking to them about, you know, Israel being restored. And then for all of a sudden it to shift as the primary meaning to be writings coming, you know, the stick of Joseph, and especially the Mormon emphasis on, well, because Lehi was from Manasseh, He is the stick of Joseph. The Book of Mormon is the stick of Joseph. That would just be pretty weird that Ezekiel in his prophecy would be going there. But yet you're kind of saying, and Phil, would it be too much to go after that in Sunday school, but then still say, but we know it can be multivalent. They can have many meanings, or is it just what Jana suggests there? Does that feel good to you? Would your wider view of restoration sort of help do something like Jana is suggesting of, you know, teaching both? Like, is there a concept where you could say we're teaching the scripture here versus we're teaching broader truth here? And does that kind of come into play here where we're clearly saying with this stick of Joseph, stick of Judah, Book of Mormon, Bible thing here, we're not really teaching the scripture, but we may be teaching something broader that we could still honor?
Yes. Well, you asked several things there, and the first one was, would my meditation on different meanings of restoration come into play? And I don't know your response, Jana, but my response was, in Jana words, you're saying exactly what I said when you asked, why do we do that? And then talked about claiming that heritage, that we're so eager to claim that heritage. That's that first sense of restoration, that we have this map in our heads that everything about restoration is to bring back that which once was and was lost, and that it all perfectly coheres. And so, absolutely, Dan, I think if we had a more notion of the range of meanings that Joseph used and enacted restoration with, then we wouldn't be caught in that trap, so that we could... The whole history of the interpretation of the Bible is full of that sort of things. Later biblical writers appropriated earlier words of scripture and prophets and used them to their ends. And New Testament writers did that to the Hebrew Bible texts. And medieval people did that to earlier writers. And that's actually what defines Jewish use of scriptural interpretation, especially in the form of interaction with the Talmud, is that there's a centuries-long conversation of commentaries on commentaries on commentaries, but there it's a little more conscious than in our context. So absolutely, if we were a little more true to Joseph's expansive notion of restoration, we wouldn't be painted into a corner of naive and errant application of scriptures. But I underscore Jana's notion that that doesn't need to annihilate the spirit of what we're trying to say. The church has just come out, as we all know, in the past week or two with a statement about the history of blacks in relation to the priesthood. And in that statement, we seem to acknowledge that a certain interpretation of scriptures, theories about why blacks couldn't hold the priesthood were velcroed on to the racism of the time and of an earlier time that we inherited, like all people inherited, only we had our distinctive justifications that started to develop by scripture. And the church explicitly disavows those theories now and condemns racism past and present. And so by their own leadership and statement there, we can see that that same process may go on among us on all sorts of scriptural application. So the tradition, I wrote about it in Mormons and the Bible, and off the top of my head, I can't remember the exact date that that interpretation of Ezekiel 37 started to appear, but it wasn't until the early 1830s, you know, it wasn't around when, in Joseph's head, as far as we know, when the Book of Mormon itself was translated and published. So it was proposed somewhere and then caught on, and then Joseph, apparently the idea didn't originate with him, but he latched on to it. And I've latched on to things. Most all of us humans latch on to interpretation of texts or events, sometimes that under critical thought turn out not to hold up. And that's okay. We're humans and we're in a historical process, and we need to, if we're going to be faithful to God, need to be self-critical about that. And I like how Jana put it about honoring the people of the Bible. It's sort of like we Mormons have had to have it drawn to our attention that casually baptizing victims of the Holocaust does not go over too well in that culture. So also we sort of need to honor that context for what it was in the, as Jana quite rightly points out, in the most traumatic point of Israel's history to date. So our God is a God of truth, as the Book of Mormon proclaims, and we can hold up under correcting ourselves. How far I go with that in a Sunday school class, you asked, and I try, given the nature of what Sunday school is and the amount of time available for a given discussion and the devotional purpose of the setting, I try to state things positively as much as can be. I try not to make it a disruptive period, but I might say something that it's kind of interesting that tradition developed among us in the early 1830s and afterwards, linking interpreting Ezekiel 37 as we have, and that maybe that we can give it a new application like that for purposes of our thinking about those intimate relations between the texts that Jana alluded to, sort of like Jesus appropriates a Seder meal, a meal celebrating in Jewish context the destroying angel passing over the firstborn of Israel when the firstborn of Egypt was to be cursed and their lives taken. And Jesus, or the memory of Jesus in the early church, appropriated that meaning of those events and made a new meaning out of it, which we call the sacrament, or others call Mass or the Eucharist. And that sort of appropriation isn't inappropriate by definition. It isn't always inappropriate, but it would be wiser of us to do it consciously and to do it by putting in the clutch a little more deliberately and shifting gears without dishonoring the original context and the people's experience there.
Good. I think the word consciously there is really what we're all seeking for. Jana, did that connect with you, kind of what Phil just said? And did you have more on the Ezekiel 37, or just this whole idea of what would you want in Sunday school to happen?
Yes, it totally connected with me. And Phil has a way of taking whatever incoherent ramblings I have and then making them sound so eloquent. So thank you, Phil, for that. I think that, yes, this is one of a number of passages that we tend to maybe cherry pick a little bit into the Old Testament for our own purposes. Everyone does that, okay? I'm not saying that Mormons are unique in any way for doing this. And yet, conscious, again, being conscious of that tendency and making an effort to try to understand this in its original context is key. However, I would say, unfortunately, that the manual is not structured in a way to help the teacher do that. The manual is not structured as history. It's structured for the application that I was talking about earlier, and we do that very well. But if you are trying to teach this with historical integrity, you have your work cut out for you. I mean, you have to bring that yourself as the teacher, and you have to use outside sources in order to do that well and to do it faithfully to the text. And in my experience, actually, students in the class greatly appreciate it when they do, because they want to know more about the Old Testament. They want to understand this better. And, you know, if you've been a Mormon for, let's say, going to gospel doctrine class, that means that you've had this particular manual how many times? I mean, we know this stuff, and we know how we can understand the moral of the story. But let's go deeper historically. Let's try to understand it in its own very complicated context. What we risk there is realizing, wow, these people in the Bible, they're very flawed. And that brings its own issues. But I think it's absolutely worth it for us to do that.
Yeah, yeah. What, maybe Carrie, just because I want to make sure that you stay in the conversation with us here. What, either from your own biblical studies or your African, you know, Haitian, Indian, you know, teachings or something, what comes alive when you really do look at them in the ancient setting and really kind of feel like what gets totally missed that you, one of your favorite things that does come out when people understand it that way?
The whole idea of what God created us for, what he created us for when he made us as male and female, our relationship with the world, really. There's this wonderful aha experience when you understand what something really means. Like, I'm quoting Scott Barchi, you know Scott Barchi, who's spoken at Sunstone a couple of times. But you've got throughout the New Testament, if I'm allowed to say New Testament in the Old Testament discussion here, Jesus takes on the title of the Son of Man. And that always felt so good to me as a child. Jesus is the Son of Man, but I had no idea what it meant. Well, Barchi says it's a reference back to the book of Daniel, when the Son of Man is referred to as one to whom all the whole world would bow before his feet and pay homage to him. And so Jesus takes on this title, which has a very profound meaning in a very hierarchical culture. And then he turns it around and then becomes the Son of Man, who doesn't have a place to lay his head and who serves others rather than being served. So I think that's the real joy of reading the Old Testament, of understanding where we're coming from and how God persevered with us, even though we insist on clinging to our own will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So okay. So Jana, you've called for teachers to do the background work. You think it's worth it to have it come alive. Carrie, that piece in Daniel is a very small piece that would take a lot of study for somebody to get to. But do you guys? I'm going to be with you that it's worth it, and to have Phil's expanded view of what God's up to and prophets are up to and all these different things. I'm going to go with you guys. Let's just, before we lose track of this, what's your favorite sources for, like, what was your best guide to Old Testament? What was your best guide towards, you know, understanding ancient Israelite culture or something that we might recommend? So, Phil, I'll start with you, and then Jana, and then Carrie. So give us some best sources.
One of my favorites would be in the Anchor Bible series, which has, I forget how many volumes, but there's an independent volume for Genesis and a different one for Exodus by different authors. So an example of a superb and accessible, very readable analysis of Genesis and its context and what's going on there is a scholar by the name of E.A. Spicer, S-P-E-I-S-E-R. So in the Anchor Bible series, that commentary would be an illustration of something that's terrific. And another suggestion that comes to mind is to see if you could find different translations of the Bible to compare with your King James Version that we use in a LDS official context. And the best one that I know of is spectacularly successful by my ear in translating into English something of the rhythm and ancientness, primitiveness, and profundity of the first five books of the Bible. So it's called The Five Books of Moses. Everett Fox is the translator. He's talking about Moses by tradition rather than literally asserting that Moses is the author of those five books. And I would just recommend that someone grab it from the library or purchase it and have it on your shelf to Because feeling that different cadence, rhythm, repetition in the way that he does it can help pull you more self-consciously out of your 21st century American or English-speaking world and into an ancient time frame that makes you be alert for all the similarities and differences that you're getting into when you enter a different world like the biblical world.
Awesome. Very interesting. Jana, any favorites? As Publishers Weekly's former editor of religion books, did you come across anything there that you love?
Yes, I have a lot of great suggestions. I love the Anchor Bible series. That's a great suggestion from Phil. There are other commentary series that are non-technical and that if you don't have any background in Hebrew, you can still understand. The For Everyone series is great. All of the Old Testament volumes in that series are by John Goldingay, who's an Old Testament professor, I think at Fuller Seminary, British guy. And it's fantastic for people who don't have a lot of background but would like to dig in. And, you know, there are a number of large reference works that are kind of one-stop shopping if you want to have the New Interpreter's Bible has a one-volume commentary that's very good. The Oxford Bible commentary is golden. That's fantastic. So there are some really superb things out there. But, you know, in answer to your question in a more negative sense, Grant Hardy a few years ago had looked at some of the current church manuals, and he looked particularly at the CES manual and counted the non-LDS sources that were quoted in that manual. So this is for the church educational system. And you'd think, right, that there would be some sort of effort to reach out into this fantastic, wonderful world of biblical scholarship that's out there. But what he found, there was a reference to the Erdmann's Handbook to the Bible, which was from 1973, a couple of Bible commentaries from the 19th century, yep. Charles Dickens's Tale of Two Cities, A Life of Christ from William Ferrers from 1874, right. And the Life of and Works of St. Paul from 1880. And essentially, the 1973 Erdmann's reference, that was the most current reference. That was the most recent reference. Most of them were from either the late 19th or early 20th century. I'm sorry, but there's just no excuse for that. You know, there has been so much amazing biblical scholarship that just illuminates, opens the eyes. And if people don't want to consult non-LDS sources, that's okay too. I mean, the Studies in Scripture series that Deseret Book has published is great too. I mean, it's definitely a more narrow perspective. It's a more narrow LDS perspective. But if that's what you want and you want to dig into the original text, well, you can get that. You know, it's great. It's important to consult these outside sources.
Awesome. Thank you. Carrie, what has been a favorite for you that kind of an easy enough foray for the average person, but it still gives them some depth?
There's a book by David Da Silva called Honor, Patronage, Kinship, and Purity. And again, this is about, this is more first century, but looking at the Greco-Roman culture, the Jewish culture as far as the whole kind of honor patronage system is really important. I think if you're understanding the Bible and what the Bible is taking a stand against. And then there's, again, this is a little too late, but again, providing this kind of cultural perspective, Kenneth Bailey's Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes and Paul Through Middle Eastern Eyes.
Cool. So for the New Testament, yeah, you're okay. Cool.
But he's talking about this whole culture.
Good.
Dan, may I enter in for a sec?
Please.
Another possibility for people would be getting a dictionary or encyclopedia of biblical interpretation, just so that they even get versed in the history or types of biblical interpretation. I think we as a church get nervous about that sort of thing because we don't want to impinge on the distinctive truths of of the restored gospel as we understand it. And there are reasons for caution. So one ought not, a Sunday school teacher out there ought not just take these books as God's eye view of everything. Mm-hmm. You need to read them critically too. But we can err by being so frightened about that sort of thing that we have an ostrich faith rather than thinking expansively and being informed, including informed by some of the beautiful truths of the gospel. And so there are things like Abington Press's Dictionary of Biblical Interpretation. Oxford puts out a magnificent recent encyclopedia that way too. So that would be another possibility.
Okay.
Also, along one volume commentary, as Jana was mentioning, some of the better ones, and another one not yet mentioned that I really love is the Jerome Biblical Commentary.
Okay, cool. All right. Okay, so let's do this. We only have about a half an hour left, so I want to focus here. What do each of you love about the Old Testament, you know, that you want to make sure can be conveyed, even as we say, yeah, this challenges some of these Mormon readings. This challenges a little bit of, you know, this is so obviously a messianic prophecy or something like that. If you're, you know, again, we're going for the both and, but what is it that excites you? And I'm going to start with Jana again, because Jana, again, this Twibel was, it's been so fun. You know, I have it, and I have enjoyed it, you know, and I get the smiles and all that, and again, it forces me to go back and see what that actual chapter, you know, says in my Bible from just reading these 140 character versions of it. But there is a sort of a spirit of this that, you know, I sense that you honor the idea that we're going to explore this scripture for a year coming up. What is it that you hope gets conveyed while at the same time saying, be careful to separate the scripture from the mythology or the, I love your term, Phil, the Velcroing on,
mm-hmm.
you know, of all this other stuff. So start with you, and then we'll go to Carrie, and then go to Phil.
So what excites me about the Old Testament that I would want to convey to people in the gospel doctrine class? Is that what you're asking?
I think so, while at the same time, you know, you're being a responsible person to the text and the ancient culture. So, in other words, here's the excitement, even though it might cost you a little bit of this, you know, safe, secure Mormon view of it.
Okay, well, here's one thing, which is the prophets. I think that the way that, you know, doing the Twibel opened my mind to the prophets, particularly the minor prophets who get such short shrift. You know, this is the group of 12 angry men who are, you know, like Amos and Hosea and Micah, fairly short books, unlike the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah. So these 12 minor prophets, I found them absolutely fascinating. And I would love to convey that passion to the class. Where that is challenging, though, for Mormons, I think, in a couple of ways. First of all, is they were so mad at everyone, and particularly on questions of social justice, questions of how we as a society deal with the poor. That was a very animating issue. And of course, that would invite some pretty potentially terrible, dangerous conversations in gospel doctrine class that you don't want to have in gospel doctrine class.
About which political party has the right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's
yes. Exactly. Okay. You know, as the teacher, you kind of want to steer clear of whatever is in the news as much as you can. It's not the time or the place for that. But I think that another issue that studying the prophets more seriously would have is that the notion of what a prophet is much more complicated in the Old Testament than we would expect if we're sort of juxtaposing our Mormon experience back onto the Old Testament. You know, there were many prophets, for example, all at the same time. It's not like where we have one prophet dies, another prophet takes his place. You know, it's in nowhere close to being that tidy and clean. So that's kind of challenging in and of itself. There were women prophets. You know, this is another issue. And one of my big beefs with the Gospel Doctrine Manual is how Deborah from the Book of Judges gets completely stomped upon in our gospel doctrine manual. It's kind of upsetting. So
tell
in
us.
Deborah,
okay, yeah, please.
Oh, I'm going to, believe me. Yes.
All right. Yay.
I'm very excited to tell you about how angry I am about Deborah, because in the Book of Judges, Deborah is the most righteous leader. She's, you know, the Book of Judges goes from bad to worse, basically. But early in the book, you still have hope that they're going to pull it together and somehow make all this work. And of course, they don't. But Deborah, who rules for 40 years, does a really good job. In fact, better than anybody else. You never get the notion from looking at the Gospel Doctrine Manual that she was the ruler. You never also get the notion that she's a prophetess. That word is not used in the manual, whereas in the Hebrew Bible, it's very obvious because a prophet is called Navi and a female prophet is a Naviah. You know, there's no question that that was her role. And what the manual says is kind of hilarious. So what did the Lord command Barak to do? And then it says, see Judges 4:6-7. How did Barak feel about this assignment? Well, the answer to that question is that the Lord commanded Barak to do jack squat, because he doesn't talk to Barak. He's talking to Deborah. Deborah is the one who's sitting under the tree, and she receives the revelation. She summons Barak and then says, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go take position at Mount Tabor, et cetera, et cetera. So Deborah's entire prophetic role, which is so clear in the actual Bible, is nowhere to be found in the Gospel Doctrine Manual. And the question that is asked about Deborah is, what can we learn from Deborah about being a true friend, that she's a true friend to Barak? Mm. So it's just basically the old saw about behind every good man is a good woman. You know, it's it's upsetting what happens to Deborah here. So I think, yes, teachers need to know about Deborah. They need to teach the actual text. Some very interesting conversations could result.
Yeah. And hopefully with some of the things we've talked about here, Phil's wider framing, talking about the, you know, just context and ancient settings are not the same as ours, and yet that's okay, that, you know, God might structure things differently. Well, I don't even know if I want to go there, obviously, because I want to keep open room for women prophets today. But anyway, I can see that. But boy, that would have to be a careful conversation. Do you think you could pull it off, Jana?
Well, as you can probably tell, I get fairly animated about some topics, and probably not.
Well, but in some ways, you could probably pull it off, because even if you did this for, if you did a 10-minute, like, okay, I'm going to let loose here, everybody, for 10 minutes, I think people would still love you, right?
I hope so. I have a wonderful word. They're fairly tolerant of me.
Yeah. But I think it, in some ways, showing the passion of that without having to nail down all the, you know, the fancy corners and all the extensions of stuff, I think that actually could be a fairly successful moment in a class, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you. I think I'm going to make sure I'm there for that week. see what I could pull off. That'll be fun.
You would be very welcome.
Awesome. Carrie, anything, you know, from you that just like, man, I love this scripture for this reason, and I don't want it to get lost, even though I recognize that there may be some challenges to Mormon, you know, we got it all figured out kind of stuff.
Well, I've done a lot of work with the Song of Solomon, which I think is more appropriately called the Song of Songs. And of course, that gets you into all kinds of problems in the LDS setting. I bet it's not even in the manual.
Yeah, and what was it? Wasn't there a Kimball had a famous thing about it should just be stapled when you get your new scriptures, just staple that shut?
You are kidding.
I think
oh
it was
Ed,
you got it. Do you know that, Carrie? Or it seems
oh,
like
yes,
a,
yes.
Yeah, it was at Kimball. I'm just kind of remembering that.
You know, I'm not sure, but Joseph Smith said that it was not inspired, which is the source of the problem with Mormons and the Song of Songs.
Right.
But I think it's not in the manual. I just looked at the table of contents, and it's not here anywhere.
I would be surprised if it were. I've done presentations on it at Sunstone, and immediately got into arguments about what Joseph Smith said about it and why. And it's like, I'm just trying to look at the text.
That's right. And it's so great. It's like this amazing exploration of sensuality and sexuality. And oh.
Yes. And
Eros.
The relationship as it becomes... it becomes a deeper thing too. So it's really quite beautiful. And of course it's the first thing that kids go to when they're, you know, teenagers reading the Bible as they look up the Song of Solomon. So it's too bad that we have to shy away from it.
Okay. So, but that's there, you know, let's say you were sitting in a gospel doctrine class and say, you know, we just passed over from here to here, and in the middle of this is the Song of Solomon. I want you all to know that it's there. I want you to, let's just know that, you know, today's, what would you say, today's views about sexuality and our worries about it and how dangerous it is, this wasn't the same thing as the ancient culture, and you could probably frame that in a good way, couldn't you, and just kind of work that into a class?
Probably. You'd have to go off book. Is that allowed? Going off book. I mean, when you teach about Barak, Jana, do you have to stick with what's exactly in the gospel doctrine? I mean, I used to get in trouble because I was a social relations teacher and I would not teach from the manual. But
well, I let my students know in advance if I was going to have a different lesson. For example, when we were teaching the Old Testament, I taught at least two lessons on the Psalms, and in the manual there's only one. I think that's a travesty, you know. There should be, we should spend a whole year on the Psalms, you know.
Right.
So yeah, I did do that. I taught a lesson on the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, and we took a day to do that. But I think that people are there to learn. Most people are very open and excited about having new things to learn about. So if you frame it positively, I suppose there's always room for that. But then again, hey, I'm in primary now, so maybe it didn't work out so well with me as gospel doctrine teacher.
I doubt they're related, but anyway. Okay, so, well, Carrie, I guess I was saying that was, you've been, went to a very specific thing, but like just in general, what about just, what do you love about diving into this, you know, 5,000-6,000 years ago kind of history and culture and things like that, that you can convey positively and yet still be aware that, you know, if you go too much in this thing, you're going to upset people beyond their ability to even hear the positive anymore?
There are a lot of little insights I think you can give people that leads to that aha experience and understanding things that you never quite understood. You know, what's that there for? What does that mean? And then when you have just a little bit of background, then you said, oh, that's what that meant. The whole thing throughout Genesis about bride price. Now, we don't practice bride price, but that was very common, especially among polygamous people, that you had to pay the clan in order to marry a woman because women did all the work.
Nice.
If you have polygamy, then you need to, you've created a market for women, right? So just seeing some of what's going on in Genesis, in Leviticus, when they mention, I think in King James, they'll use the expression, endow her to be a wife, right? Just knowing what that little phrase means makes sense out of some of these stories. I mean, obviously the story of Jacob and working for Leah and being stuck with Rachel and having to start all over again.
Other way around. He wanted Rachel and he got stuck with Leah.
So things like, for instance, I think it's in Leviticus, it says that, this is not terribly edifying, but if a man entices a maid to lie with him, he shall endow her to be his wife. And people read that and say, oh, the Bible says that if a man rapes you, then you have to marry him. And isn't that awful? Now, it is true that in a lot of the world that's what happens. You have marriage by rape. But what the Bible was saying is that if a man entices a virgin to lie with him, whether, you know, by force or otherwise, he will pay her bride price. In other words, he will support her as a wife, but she doesn't have to live with him. You know, so it's one of these kind of, oh, that's what that's talking about. there's a long passage somewhere about marrying women taken in war, and about if you want to marry a woman who was captured in war, then you go through this kind of purification ritual and trim her nails and cut her hair. And people are saying, oh, isn't this awful, the demeaning of this woman who's being taken in war, these awful things you're doing to her. But you're sort of missing the point that most of the peoples around there, if they captured a woman in war, they just raped her. You know, in the Old Testament, if you wanted to have sex with a woman taken in war, you had to marry her. You know, so it's really, I don't know, it's kind of fun that way.
It's more progressive. And there's like a waiting period for sexual relations, right? For this woman, doesn't she get a month or two? I can't remember exactly.
Right, yes. Uh-huh. So it's sort of this, those things that they're doing is a way of disconnecting her from her old culture and bringing her into the new. But it's quite a bit different than what we often think it means.
Mm. Cool. Well, thank you, Carrie. And the commentaries and things that you guys would talk to us about will help with all that stuff. I guess I'm trying to get a feel, and let me go to Phil next, and then anybody, and then we'll kind of go to closing. I know, Jana, you especially have to go within 10 minutes or so. So, Phil, can you, what is exciting about this year of Scripture that is it's worth, you know, really conveying, even at the same time that you're going to say to somebody, I know this isn't going to jive exactly with the easy Mormon story, but we can handle it. You know, how would you convey both sides of those?
Well, I get excited in looking at these texts at the collage of human striving, the layers and tension, conflicts even in human striving. The prophets are not perfect. They're very human. And
this might be a good time to make that point. You know, that might be at the right timing for us on the heels of the blacks and the priesthood admissions here. Maybe Old Testament's coming along at the right time, right?
Yeah, and I'm afraid there will be some, because I've seen commentary about this statement sort of either taking glee or having a loss of nerve, like if the prophets were human and we've been led to believe that we'd never been led astray and we were so subject to the culture of our times, then how can we trust anything? I really think we need to be more sophisticated and, again, resilient than that. Looking into the texts and story and personalities and strivings of the Hebrew people and the Hebrew Bible is part of what led me to a formula. It seems like I may even have pronounced it to you before in an interview, Dan, but it is something I formulated a quarter of a century ago for myself, and that is the church is not essentially divine with only a few flaws because its leaders are human, but just the obverse of that. The church is made up entirely of human beings, and though we're in a modern 21st century context, we're human like those ancient Hebrews were human, and the church is entirely made up of human beings who are striving to respond to the divine with which they've been touched, or with which in faith we believe we've been touched. And if we will take occasion to study the, Carrie was talking about some things with sexuality that Mormon sensibilities can be not just sensitive, but hypersensitive to, and not deal with some of the raw, important realities that are there, that are part of human existence that God presides over. So just the rawness, the humanness, but the impulse, the belief, the faith, the striving to rise and respond to something higher is much more inspiring than a faith of perfect styrofoam or something yeah. Looks flawless, that is a gilded lily map. It's not nearly so rich and inspiring. I'm excited about when Jana talked about what are sometimes called the minor prophets, not meaning unimportant, but smaller books of Micah and Hosea and Amos. When Micah teaches us after thinking about sacrifice and ritual and all manner of the dimensions, all aspects of the dimension of Israel's religion, and says, but what doth the Lord require of thee? This is King James, which is the most beautiful translation of this passage that I know of, despite other things we've said here earlier. What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with thy God? What is religion? What's its core and where is it thrusting? I love that sense of mercy, compassion, concern for rightness, and not just personal ethics, but creating a peoplehood that's worthy of the Lord and inflected by God consciousness and responding to something higher. And I'm excited by our modern notions of prophets, as I think you, Dan, said earlier, or at least my mind went there when you said something related about prophets who, or maybe Janet, was you, prophets who replace each other in tidy, well-organized fashion. And there's nothing wrong with organization. There can be something wrong with hyper-organization that can smush the life out of things, as Jesus taught us relentlessly. But there's nothing wrong with good organization. But what is a prophet, and where did the notion first come from? And clearly, the roots are in the Old Testament, influencing Joseph, even though he and his experience led him in his own directions. So the most profound analysis that I've ever come across of what a prophet is by the marvelous de facto prophetic scholar and thinker and religious leader Abraham Heschel, 20th century Jewish scholar. And he wrote a book called The Prophets, cleverly enough. And in his analysis, the quintessence of what a prophet is, and I'm writing about related things and was just talking about a related thing back at Notre Dame a week or two ago, and so I have it in front of me, if you'll forgive me for reading a paragraph. In Heschel's view, quote, an analysis of prophetic utterances shows that the fundamental experience of the prophet is a fellowship with the feelings of God, sympathy with the divine pathos, a communion with the divine consciousness, which comes about through the prophet's reflection of or participation in the divine pathos. The typical prophetic state of mind is one of being taken up into the heart of the divine pathos. The prophet hears God's voice and feels his heart. He tries to impart the pathos of the message. As an imparter, his soul overflows, speaking as he does out of the fullness of his sympathy. So out of all the different roles and shades of meaning and tasks that we carry around in our heads about what a prophet, Heschel's analysis takes us there, and we might link with Joseph Smith's identifying with Enoch in his meta-historical passage there in Moses 7, and apply it to Heschel when all eternity shook because God brought Enoch to see the chaos and tribulation and history of his people. So I love the profundity that's there to be mined and thought about, extracted, debated, pondered, prayed about amidst the mess and blood and sins and confusion and progress of the people across Hebrew history.
Thank you. Wonderful. Jana, I know you have to go to the theater.
The theater.
Let's let you close with any final thoughts, and then you can take off, and I'll close with Carrie and Phil just briefly after that.
Well, that was beautiful. The Heschel quote. All I can say is amen. It was phenomenal. And it is a wonderful way of thinking about prophecy for our context as well. I think I'll leave it at that. It has been such a joy to speak with all of you. And I hope that this wonderful year coming up in 2014 is very good from a perspective of learning about the scriptures. I had a great deal of fun with the Twible Project, and now I need to find another way to discipline myself to read the scriptures myself.
another reason, another yeah. project, yeah. Thank you, Jana, for being with us. We'll let you go. Always love having you. Thanks for suggesting this topic, and we'll
Thank
talk
you.
To you later.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, Jana.
Carrie, what's on your brain as a kind of a final thought as we head out the door here? Was there something that you were hoping to share today that you weren't able to?
I really like what Phil was saying, and back to a bit of the conversation earlier about making biblical passages our own. And this is in the context of the sticks. I mean, you don't want to do proof texting, obviously, or cherry picking, mm-hmm. I think Jana called it. But the idea of finding something and finding modern meaning in it, I think is something that is real proof of the inspiration in the scriptures, is that, yes, it meant this in this setting here, but what does it mean to me? And what can I take from this so that it is meaningful in my life and brings me closer to God? So I think that's a real joy. In my experience in kind of moving around within Protestant Christianity is that Mormons are extremely scriptural literate. If there's a problem, I think it's that we sort of assume that, well, if it's in the Bible, it's not just reporting, it's what God wanted it to be. And even when the prophets did horrible things, that must have been what God wanted, which is get you into some problems, I think.
Right.
I don't think that God was very happy with the Old Testament polygamy on a lot of levels, for instance. But so I think you need some discretion, I think, in just applying everything to our own lives today. But there's real beauty in that, and I thought Phil expressed that very well.
Awesome. Yeah, there's that whole business of the more particular you are, the more universally applicable or connecting it can be. So that by going very specific in this culture and you recognize this isn't the same as me, so I don't have to try to fit it. But yet, by connecting with those people and theirs, you can find those
yes.
parallels. You know, and so when you think they're just like us or their culture was just like us, you miss that thing. So again, I love, you know, Chaim Potok's books about Hasidic Judaism. You know, it's so different from my world, but yet I can totally see all the parallels because he was so particularly just articulating that. Those kinds of things, I think, a little bit less what prompted from what you just said there. So I love that. So thank you. Loved having you on. Can't wait to get you back. You and I will have to talk another time and figure out some areas to apply some of your
okay,
studies.
Okay, sounds like fun.
So thank you. Phil, anything left on your notepad? Any more quotes that you had earmarked to share today?
Well, I've enjoyed being on with all three of you, so thanks for hosting this, Dan. And Carrie, you've intrigued me enough to make sure I hunt up more Carrie things. So, no, it's an infinitely rich, broad topic, so no illusions of being comprehensive here. This reiterates something said earlier, but I would not want our Mormon distinctiveness to dissolve into being like everybody else. I think there are precious, delightful breakthrough insights that Joseph brought to us, but we're, as a people, so protective of that and so concerned that someone may walk out of bounds somewhere, as inevitably will happen with more freedom, but we ought to not be so fenced in, so spiritually constipated, so protective in a fortress mentality that we fail to live gospel standards completely by forgetting the 13th article of faith, which reminds us that if there's anything admirable and trustworthy and virtuous and praiseworthy, no matter its source, that we're to seek after and embrace those things and make them part of our faith. So while we have to be careful and critical, as I suggested earlier, I think that finding worthy scholarship and finding accurate insights into the ancient world, and be careful about illicit appropriations so that we're more responsible, is a way to worship and honor God, and not being afraid of errors of the past as we try to think our set ways and pray our ways and live our ways to more lucid minds and spirits is a good thing. So we ought to welcome new understandings and approaches and not ridicule a basic conservatism, because there are principles to conserve and protect and be careful with. But so we need to value liberalism, the freedom and the progress that we're invited to do eternally, and we need to be careful and conserve that which is treasurable. I think, for instance, when we, over the decades, people have written manuals, as we said earlier on the program, where outside sources are not utilized, and what few outside sources are utilized are antique, which I understand the Mormon impulse, I think, to think that the gospel truths are eternal and we're not dependent on the latest and greatest. But in ways, it's just like embracing 19th century science as opposed to 21st century science. We've just come a little ways and we need to be not ignorant of that. But over the decades, when such tensions arose, there have been times when those who wrote the gospel manuals were instructed that they could use outside materials but never cite them. And, you know, we need to be a trifle careful with what is known in modern parlance as plagiarism. That's against basic principles of honesty as well as the 13th article of faith. And that we also have some nice resources within Mormonism. Lowell Bunyan's, like all his books, are slender but thoughtful, and he has a book called The Unknown Testament, referring to the Old Testament, that's full of wonderful insights in the spirit of Lowell Bunyan, who I call the conscience of 20th century Mormonism. The Mother Teresa of 20th century Mormonism, in some ways, is infused with that spirit. And we might even think about our methods, and while we're on the subject of Lowell Bunyan, and think about our pedagogy in Sunday school. He thought our manuals were too often abominable in recent decades, towards the end of his life, and thought that a good lesson for church type classes or his own LDS Institute of Religion classes were comprised of one idea unpacked and surveyed and examined and discussed and repackaged with a thesis, as opposed to water skiing along the texts in order to get through all the books on time. I think we need to be careful of homogenization, Mormonization of everything that we talk about, because when we Mormonize everything, we're Mormonizing with a certain map or notion of what Mormonism even is. And I've tried to suggest here that it's bigger and wider, what Joseph brought, than we sometimes realize. And so when we try to homogenize and Mormonize everything, we're really sometimes doing a form of idolatry and making things in our own image instead of exploring what they are. So I think it's useful to respect and use the Book of Mormon and the Pearl of Great Price, for instance, as additional revelations, additional sources of information and inspired things that we need to study, but we don't need to work as hard as we usually do to make them seamless with the quite distinct world of the Hebrew Bible. So those are some thoughts that cross my mind. And again, thanks for having me along with other good folks.
Thank you, sir. Wow, amazing. Carrie, thanks for being on. Listeners, please come to the blog, mormonmatters.org, comment on this episode, share your ideas. What have you found that works well in these things? Phil, maybe actually, that reminds me, I had a question, not this last group, but the time back. When you did that reframing that you said for yourself for 25 years ago, instead of thinking of the church as perfect with only the few flaws being because of humans, and thinking instead of, you know, now reversing it to it's thoroughly human with the strivings for the divines and things breaking through. Has that gone over well? Have you been explicit in like a devotional setting and had that go over well?
Yes, I've spoken on that all over. I first published it as part of that collection of faith statements by Mormon scholars called A Thoughtful Faith. Back in 1986, but so I've had time to be critical and think about it over time, and it's still a core understanding for me as a platform for a responsible faith.
But and you are saying yes, you've been able to teach that in a church setting.
That's right.
Without people. Okay, great. So that's a wonderful one. So yeah, listeners, things like that, things that you've done well, things that you've seen teachers do well. Please come to the blog and share and be part of this. It's Christmas. Merry Christmas to everybody. I want to say thank you to those who've been so generous this month and the extra bit that they've donated. I know that some of you are still planning to do that. Know that I absolutely am grateful. It's been such a humbling month to receive so many well wishes as well as things that come in the form of financial assistance for this podcast. We've got a lot going. We're going to keep it going strong next year. So any donations that make it by the end of the year, definitely tax deductible. We'll get all that paperwork to you in the month of January. And anyway, just know I appreciate you already. And thank you for those who are still yet to donate. Carrie, again, we'll talk to you another time. Thanks for being on. And Phil, thank you. And Jana, we had to say goodbye to you a while ago. We appreciate you. And let's just all offer a good night.
Thank you, Dan. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
My pleasure. Thanks to all of you.
Good night, everybody. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. All is well. All is well. All is well.